From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com. America and other Western nations are choosing to throw away a key driver of their prosperity. That's the complaint of author and nationally known political pundit Jonah Goldberg. He outlined his concerns during a recent visit to North Carolina. The UNC system has a new interim president. He's a familiar face from the world of health care. You'll hear from him. Greenville is the largest North Carolina city with a conservative mayor. You'll hear from him. He shares his priority list. And we'll assess what North Carolina voters had to say recently about judicial elections and proposed constitutional amendments. Speaking of elections, that's the topic Donna Martinez addresses as she joins us now with the Carolina Journal headline.
North Carolina Democrats had hoped to take control of the General Assembly on November 6, but voters failed to give the Democrats the ballot box wins necessary to wrest the majority from state Republicans. But that does not mean that Democrats didn't do well on election night, particularly in metropolitan areas. Voters did give them enough victories to break the Republican veto-proof majorities in both legislative chambers. That may well mean a different dynamic at the legislature come January. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President for the John Locke Foundation. She joins me now to talk about what this all means. Becky, welcome back. And are you glad election time is over?
Yes, I am. I think everyone is.
Absolutely.
Get back to those ads for toilet paper and deodorant.
There you
again.
Go. Yeah. So it's going to be an interesting time. First of all, explain to us what is going to be different in the legislature in terms of the power and influence and votes based on November.
Right, and this is going to be a big change. Currently, the Republicans hold a supermajority in both the House and the Senate. Now, what that means is they have the votes to override any veto that the governor may put into place. And the Democrats have complained about this, that it really makes the Democrats' voice much less influential, particularly in those issues that revolve around elections, budgets, those kind of things. What this election has done is it has willowed away those super majorities. Republicans still have control of both the House and the Senate, which means that we will have a Republican speaker, a Republican president of the Senate. The committee chairs will most likely be mostly Republican. But what it does is it is going to narrow down what they can do because of the governor's veto. Now, it doesn't mean they can't do anything. Donna, you may recall in 2011, we had a situation where the Senate had a supermajority, but the House did not. And so in order to get things done, that was when Speaker Tom Tillis was running that chamber. In order to get things done, he had to get cooperation, get votes from some moderate Democrats. They overrode Governor Beverly Perdue's veto of the state budget and other things. They put some tax reforms into place. They began to roll back regulations. They lifted the cap on charter schools. So it doesn't mean that things aren't going to get done. It just means it's going to be a little bit more difficult under this new landscape we'll be working with.
What will this mean for policy priorities? Will we still be working on the agenda of the Republicans?
Well, I think, you know, and we're looking at this very closely at the John Locke Foundation as we get ready to go into the session and prepare and where we're going to put our resources and where we believe that there can be real inroads for free market policies. I think what we're going to be doing is looking for areas where there is consensus, where there are things that we can work together on. And by we, I mean all of us, everyone involved in sort of the public policy debate in North Carolina. I think that there are some issues that we've already seen everyone can get on board. If you look at the hurricane relief and the how the $2 billion savings account has been spent addressing the needs of the hurricane victims, we're going to continue to see that. I think we'll see that in the November 27th session. I think that we'll see that going into 2019. Some of the other things, you know, things like reform of the ABC system in North Carolina, something we've written about, talked about. This last session, it got a lot of attention. Some of the craft beer and craft spirits industries really growing in North Carolina. And what we found was there was consensus on both sides of the aisle that, yeah, reforms need to be put into place in a pretty antiquated system. Healthcare is something else that a lot of people are concerned about. The access to healthcare, particularly in rural areas in North Carolina, I think is something that Republicans and Democrats recognize the problem, recognize something that needs to be done, looking for solutions to that. So it's going to be a little bit different in that Republicans are going to have to take a little bit of a step backward in their agenda and their policy priorities, recognizing that there is a stopgap that is provided by the governor's veto and a smaller majority control that they have.
Speaking of the governor, what does this mean for his involvement in public policy in North Carolina? Not necessarily even his public profile, but being more involved perhaps in policy discussions?
Well, I think so. And we've already seen this. One of his reactions to the election was, number one, he said that he was looking forward and hoped to work with legislative leaders. I think that's a good sign. He also mentioned two specific things that he has prioritized. One is additional funding for teachers and investment in education. And the second one is broader access to health care. So those are two issues, education funding, education investment, and access to health care. He's already identified those. Those are key issues for the legislature. So I think, you know, already we're getting an idea of what that's going to be like. Donna, what I hope doesn't happen is what has happened in Washington, where there is gridlock and there is just refusal to work together entirely. I also hope that the next 2 years are not spent with either side or both sides trying to make political plugs, make, you know, quick political gains, gamemanship as far as forcing votes on particular issues to make the other side look bad. You know, that I don't think is what anyone wants. We'll certainly be doing our part at the John Lott Foundation to provide a lot of good, solid policy ideas and information, data that they can look at and hopefully drive a very positive free market, limited government agenda that will continue to improve our economy.
Would it also perhaps mean for the governor that his proposals, particularly in the budget area, might need to be more realistic since he needs to be reaching out more and there's going to be more back and forth, presumably?
Absolutely. And I think we saw that during the budget cycle of his first 2 years. His budget was very much a wish list. It was a list of priorities that I think even he recognized. There was no way that the kind of tax increases that his budget ideas would have required would ever be palatable. So, I think he's going to have to be more realistic. And I think that we'll see more compromise and negotiation between the governor's office and the General Assembly.
When it comes to the priorities of legislators, Becky, it's always been fascinating. It's no secret, and you know it better than anyone, about how rural areas of the state have different priorities a lot of times from more urban metro areas of the state. And we saw in the vote this time a bluing of the urban metro areas while the other areas were staying more red and the suburban areas kind of in the middle. Is there any way to try to ever bridge that gap?
That's going to be the biggest challenge, I think, of the next 2 years and perhaps the next decade. Just a quick point on that. In Wake County, after this election, in Wake County, there is one Republican in the Wake delegation. In Mecklenburg County, there is one, maybe two Republicans in the Mecklenburg delegation. Senator Dan Bishop and then Representative Bill Brawley is in a very tight race. We're going to have to see after some probably recounts in that race where there is. But I think that illustrates what you're talking about. And then there are more Republicans in the urban parts of the state. We have seen this divide. We've seen this struggle, whether it is the distribution of sales tax revenue, whether it is education funding, investments in infrastructure and roads, and healthcare. as well. You know, you just look at the medical facilities that are located in Wake County, Durham, Chapel Hill, Mecklenburg County. Compare that in other parts of the state. Clearly some challenges that we're going to have to address.
And I know that you will be on top of all of the actions when the General Assembly comes back. Becky Gray will be following it all, as will Carolina Journal. You can find all of that at johnlock.org and carolinajournal.com. Becky Gray, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Voters have spoken in North Carolina. How can you make sense of what they said about the legislature, Congress, the courts, the Constitution? Carolina Journal has you covered, in print each month, online every day. Carolina Journal is your source for up-to-the-minute information about North Carolina state government policies and their impact on you. Carolina Journal offers in-depth analysis of the election's aftermath, then looks ahead to 2019. How will elections affect your family, your wallet, your schools, your business? Find out in the free Carolina Journal newspaper, online at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, your number one source for government news that affects you. Visit carolinajournal.com today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Western civilization is choosing its own demise. That's the less than cheery assessment of Jonah Goldberg. The American Enterprise Institute scholar and National Review senior editor recently visited North Carolina. He shared key themes from his most recent book. It's titled Suicide of the West. Recent headlines seem to play into your book's thesis.
There are some long-term trends that have been going on in our culture for a very long time. And I think that, as I like to say, Donald Trump isn't the cause of all of our problems, but he's a symptom of them. And those symptoms are larger than just what's going on the right or just what's going on the left. They are currents that are running around through basically all of the West, including in Europe. Populism and nationalism are at the forefront. And I think phenomena that are that big and that complex are going to have manifestations of themselves at almost any given moment, for years to come.
Your book features the following subtitle, How the Rebirth of Tribalism, Populism, Nationalism, and Identity Politics is Destroying American Democracy.
What we're really experiencing in this country and across the West is a breakdown in the institutions that traditionally give us a sense of meaning and belonging in our lives. We typically call these things civil society, but it also includes things like the family. And look, what has two thumbs and loves capitalism? This guy. But capitalism can't, capitalism depends on values it cannot create and cannot restore once lost. And those values are incubated in the family and in church and synagogue and in faith. And also in all the, what Edmund Burke called the little platoons of civil society, these little institutions that give people a sense of meaning and belonging. And when they break down, what happens is we don't lose our desire for meaning and belonging. We look to other things to provide them. And among the things that historically have done that are things like tribalism or nationalism or populism or just simply politics. And more people are turning to politics for a sense of meaning and belonging and tribal identity. And it's profoundly unhealthy.
You mentioned the breakdown of civil society. How are we seeing this today?
One of the things I try to do in the book is work on the assumptions that modern, secular, progressive, people who aren't necessarily conservative consider to be the sort of central things. Science, evolution, right? Economics, material metrics about well-being. And what we see is that capitalism has done unbelievably, truly miraculous things for improving man's material condition, for improving our public health, longevity. You can go down an incredibly long list that people like Steven Pinker have turned into a whole book. But what it can't do is fill the holes in your soul. It can't give you a sense of meaning or belonging. And so one of the things that we're seeing today, just look at the rise of partisanship. social scientists are kind of overwhelmed by the fact that one's partisan identity is now a bigger driver of attitudes and behavior for millions of people than religion or ethnicity or even sex or gender or race are. And that's because our desire to sort of, as the normal institutions that provide those things wither, we attach ourselves to these partisan causes. And so you have an enormous rise in what they call negative partisanship. Negative partisanship is about how there are millions of people who the only reason they call themselves Democrats is because they hate Republicans. And the only reason why millions of people call themselves Republicans is because they hate Democrats. That's a very tribal way of viewing the world. In tribal societies, which is what we all evolved in, our brains are designed to see the people like us or the people that we form coalitions with as good, and everybody outside is the dangerous other. And that is defining so much of our politics these days, where you have people say that it's worth being a jerk so long as the right people are offended. People defending some of the things that Donald Trump says or tweets purely on the grounds that it's, you know, that liberal tears are delicious, that kind of thing. And you see the same phenomenon on the left with people going after the right, mocking religion, mocking traditionalism, purely because it makes, you know, Mike Pence sad. And this is a profoundly unhealthy way to think about politics.
That's the voice of Jonah Goldberg, scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, senior editor at National Review, and author of the recent book Suicide of the West. You use the word miraculous, and your book talks about threats to a capital M miracle. What's the miracle?
The reason I chose the word miracle and not the Enlightenment, right, or even modernity, is that, first of all, it's miraculous. It is bizarre. For 250,000 years, or however long Homo sapiens existed since we split off from the Neanderthals, the average human being everywhere in the world lived on no more than $3 a day. Man's natural environment was grinding poverty, punctuated by an early death, either from violence or some bowel-stewing disease. And then once and only once in all of human history did human prosperity for the average person, not some aristocrat, not some pharaoh or emperor, start to go up. And it's been going up ever since. That's just six lifetimes that we've leapt out of our natural state, in a sense. Or even if you want to go back to the agricultural revolution, that was only 10,000 years ago. We existed for hundreds of thousands of years before that. And one of the reasons why I call it a miracle is that it's just simply miraculous, the transformation that we have. But also because we really don't understand why it happened. There are lots of good theories. I think most of the theories are actually pretty good about explaining parts of it. But there is no consensus. There's a total consensus about the poverty for 250,000 years. There's no consensus about why we got out of it. And so part of my understanding of what a miracle is it's some glorious, wonderful thing that happens that you can't explain. Now, as part of my argument, I don't attribute it to God. I have no problem with people who do. But what I'm trying to do is persuade people who come from that other side of the political aisle that even if you don't think God has anything to do with it, that we should still have a profound sense of gratitude for it. And for me, conservatism is best understood as a disposition of gratitude. You look around the world, you look around your society, and you see those things that are valuable, that are lovely, that you want to pass on to the next generation. Maybe improved, but certainly not degraded. And you only can do that if you have a sense of gratitude for them. And instead, in this country, we teach ingratitude. We teach ingratitude as a matter of higher education, of popular culture. We teach people that they're owed something. We teach people to be resentful. Resentment is the opposite of gratitude. And when you have that attitude, when you have that mindset that says, I'm owed more than what I have, and you take everything that we have for granted, you start acting as if there are people who took what you're owed away from you. And that is the driving sense of grievance that informs so much of populism, of nationalism, of identity politics, of tribalism, of socialism, which is not in the subtitle, but easily could have been, sort of implied. And I honestly think that the way out, I mean, there are some policy things that we can do, but first of all, we need a sort of a We need to open our hearts to the fact that we're all lucky to be alive in this country, in this civilization, at this time, because no one has had it better as a generalization.
Jonah Goldberg is an American Enterprise Institute scholar, senior editor at National Review, and author most recently of Suicide of the West. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Voters have spoken in North Carolina. How can you make sense of what they said about the legislature, Congress, the courts, the Constitution? Carolina Journal has you covered. In print each month, online every day. Carolina Journal is your source for up-to-the-minute information about North Carolina state government policies and their impact on you. Carolina Journal offers in-depth analysis of the election's aftermath, then looks ahead to 2019. How will elections affect your family, your wallet, your schools, your business? Find out in the free Carolina Journal newspaper, online at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, your number one source for government news that affects you. Visit carolinajournal.com today.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. The University of North Carolina is turning to the retiring CEO of UNC Healthcare to serve as interim president of the university system. Dr. William Roper explains the change in jobs.
The last 14 plus years, I've spoken about the business of training the next generation of doctors and scientists and other health professionals. Today and moving forward, I speak from a new place with a new voice. We have work ahead to do the business that trains our next generation of teachers and nurses and innovators and veterinarians and entrepreneurs and cinematographers and philosophers and engineers and many, many others. But let's not confuse that work with our responsibility to shape minds towards inspiring humanity and kindness and a sense of belonging for all people, not only in our institutions, but in our world.
Why Roper? UNC Board Chairman Harry Smith responds.
The UNC system is a very complex asset. And so, you know, one of the things that I was looking for was somebody that actually ran and managed a sophisticated asset. And Bill has done that at the highest levels of success. And so if you take a look at UNC Healthcare, its accomplishments and its growth, I think is simply spectacular. And so, when you're managing the kind of human capital that is in the UNC system and in a diverse landscape, you look for somebody that has done that. And I don't think there's anybody any more qualified than Bill Roper is in the management oversight of an asset of this magnitude and size.
Roper hasn't set out a list of priorities, but he does offer some clues.
Very clearly, what we need most of all, and we have it, but we need it in abundance, is the support of the people of North Carolina to operate this precious activity, the state's public higher education system. It takes goodwill, but it also takes money. It takes people working together in a collegial fashion, not for this or that group, but for all North Carolinians, and that's what I'm going to be working on.
Roper is 70. How long does he expect to hold this interim job? Will it always be interim?
I really do believe in public service and believe that part of what that entails is when you're asked to do something, almost always you say yes unless there's a strong reason not to. So I've said yes to this. I'm looking forward to having supper with my wife tonight, and we'll work on tomorrow, but we're not worried about weeks and months in the future. That'll take care of itself.
That's Dr. William Roper, recently named interim president of the University of North Carolina system. He takes that new job January 1st. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. When we discuss conservative politics and policies on this program, we usually focus on state or even national issues. But conservative principles can inform local government actions as well. And one person who is putting conservative ideas to work in local government is P.J. Connolly. He's mayor of Greenville, North Carolina. It's the largest North Carolina city with a Republican mayor. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So you were recently elected as mayor of Greenville after serving on the council for a couple of years. What's the transition been like to the top job on the council there?
Well, I got to say that it was very beneficial to be on the city council for a couple of years. You kind of really learn the ropes and understanding how things work. So it's been a very big benefit to say that I was on the council for a couple of years.
What are some of the things that you're focusing on now as mayor?
Well, we started off when I was elected, we really wanted to make a focus on jobs. That was one of the main things, from a priority standpoint, we've been really focusing on bringing jobs to our community and economic development. When I was first sworn into office, one of the things we made was a tagline that said Greenville means business. So what we really wanted to focus on is growing businesses in our area that have already invested there and also bringing new businesses to our community as well. I was telling somebody earlier today, one of the things that we really are very fortunate to have is we have a great medical facility, and we also have a great university and a great community college in our area. So we're very thankful for that. But one of the things you want to do is diversify your portfolio too. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to bring private sector jobs to our community. And the city's done a lot of things moving forward with trying to hit on those priorities during our budget cycle. We put a large amount of money towards site development, and we also put some money towards workplace development as well. So we've really tried to focus on keeping it as simple as possible and working on the economic development standpoint.
Conservatives working in government can often run into some obstacles or challenges. Are there things that you have seen in working with city government that you've said, this is something we ought to fix or ought to address?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the first things that I noticed with getting into city government was how slow things move. You know, being a private sector guy myself, that can be very frustrating. So a lot of things that we're doing right now is we're trying to lay the groundwork for the future. And, you know, we understand a lot of these different initiatives that we're coming up with right now are going to take time to be able to capitalize on. So what we're trying to do is create a good base moving forward. So some of the conservative principles that we are putting in place right now will be beneficial 10, 15, 20 years from now.
What are some of those things that you're pursuing?
You know, one of the things that we really have focused on is we've had a big issue with deferred maintenance with our infrastructure. So the city council and myself have really put a big emphasis on building our infrastructure. You know, when I say that, a lot of it has to do with our road system. I'd say 9 out of 10 people that asked what the worst thing in our city was our road system. And, you know, as the mayor and the council has really made a priority to fix our roads, this year we're doing 27.1 lane miles, which is the most that the city's ever done. So what we're trying to do is when we were knocking on doors and talking to our constituents and asking them to vote for us and telling them we were going to fix our road system, we wanted to make sure that we were actually doing that. So that's been one of our main focuses so far since we've taken office.
We are chatting with PJ Connolly, mayor of Greenville, North Carolina. And as you've been pursuing some of these initiatives, are you finding some pushback from people within government or people glad to hear some of these fresh new ideas?
I think for the most part, everybody's been pretty happy. We've really tried to focus on some of the bare necessities in our community. Like I said, we've focused on the infrastructure. We've also focused on beautification. I'm big on your first impression. You only get one first impression. It better be a good one, is what I tell the city staff. So what we've done is we've really started to work on the Adopt a City Street program, and which was pretty much dead when I first got into office. So we're starting to work on that. That's been very beneficial. We're starting to clean up our city. You know, when people come into our community, like I said, that first impression is everything. We want them to come in, see that we're clean, safe, nice place to live, and tell friends that they should come and visit Greenville, North Carolina.
You mentioned having the private sector background. Are there particular things that you're trying to do as mayor or trying to have the council or the actual manager and the government staff do to make things easier for private businesses?
Absolutely. There's several things that we're doing. One of the things that I think I'm most proud about is we've created a concierge service. So when people are looking to locate or bring their businesses to the city of Greenville, they're going to have a one-point contact. It's going to make it very, very easy for planning and zoning, for permitting. They just have to go to that one person. They'll be able to walk them through the steps as far as what they can do to open up a business in Greenville. Another thing that we've done, too, is we've offered job incentives. And this is the first time this has ever happened in the city of Greenville, is we're offering job incentives for companies that want to locate in our municipality and even in our ETJ as well. What we're trying to do is we want people to grow their businesses, and we'll incentivize them based off of how many jobs they're able to create.
Now, I have to tell you, the John Locke Foundation has been an opponent of targeted tax incentives for bringing in jobs. Are you trying to put in programs that at least have some clawbacks or particular characteristics that'll make it not too easy to get the incentives?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's definitely clawbacks. I mean, it's a strict requirement. I mean, the entry level is 50 jobs that you have to bring in. So it's not just a small one. We've past administrations have gotten through this and they've created some kind of incentives to be able to create jobs. And what ends up happening is the business ends up folding, and then we're looking to find that money back. And we do have clawbacks, and they have to produce for us to be able to provide that incentive to them.
Now, as the mayor, the mayor of the largest city in North Carolina that has a Republican mayor, has it been difficult to find some other people you could turn to for ideas of good conservative things to try in city government, or are there good resources for you?
No, it's been great, actually. I've been able to have a lot of good friends in the state legislature that have been really welcoming and very helping with our mission. They understand what we're trying to do. We're just trying to grow the city of Greenville. We're not trying to make it a partisan issue with our city. We're doing the best we can, and we're fortunate enough. What we're trying to do is bring everybody together and understand that this is a team effort, and for Greenville to be able to grow, all of us are going to have to work together. So it hasn't been too partisan.
You mentioned bringing people together. That tends to be in government one of the trickier things, making sure that you can get folks on all sides to compromise or at least come to some consensus on some issues. Is that something you're having to focus on?
Yeah, it is. I mean, the tough part is when I first became the mayor of the city of Greenville, we had the county was working separate from the city. Greenville Utilities, who's our utility provider in our community, was working separately. The university is working separately. And we understand that if we want to grow our community, we want to create a good economic development environment, we're all going to have to work together. So when we're coming and knocking on the door here in Raleigh at our state legislature, we're all coming together with a one plan in place, and we're not all asking for something separate. So I think we all realize that when we work together, things will be better.
People seeing the video or hearing the audio are probably going to be able to tell. This is kind of a younger fellow. Do you have some long-term, long-in-the-distance ideas of where Greenville ought to be?
Well, you know, we just want Greenville to continue to grow. I mean, we're lucky. I think the last numbers I saw that we're growing at about a 7% rate. We want to continue to grow. We want Greenville to continue to have businesses for people when they graduate from East Carolina University or Pitt Community College. We want them to stay there, be able to raise a family there, live there, and have a great life.
All right. Well, one of the people who's going to be trying to help make that happen in Greenville, at least for the coming years as the mayor, is P.J. Connolly. We thank you so much for joining us on Carolina Journal Radio.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We'll have more in just a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Voters have spoken in North Carolina. How can you make sense of what they said about the legislature, Congress, the courts, the Constitution? Carolina Journal has you covered. In print each month, online every day. Carolina Journal is your source for up-to-the-minute information about North Carolina state government policies and their impact on you. Carolina Journal offers in-depth analysis of the election's aftermath, then looks ahead to 2019. How will elections affect your family, your wallet, your schools, your business? Find out in the free Carolina Journal newspaper, online at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, your number one source for government news that affects you. Visit carolinajournal.com today.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. North Carolina Democrats scored solid victories on November 6th in statewide races for North Carolina's two highest courts, while Republicans notched wins on several amendments to the North Carolina Constitution. Carolina Journal covering all of these stories for you at carolinajournal.com. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. He joins us now to talk about some of these big races. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
Let's talk about the big Democratic wins first when it comes to judicial races. Uh-huh. And the key race, the North Carolina Supreme Court seat, an incumbent justice goes down to defeat.
Right. Barbara Jackson, who was running for her first full term as the second full term. She was appointed, then she ran a successful race 8 years ago, and then was running for her second full term on the court, lost to Democrat Anita Earls in a race that was rather controversial from the beginning, because there was also a second Republican candidate on the ballot, Chris Anglin, a nominally registered Republican who actually was a longtime Democrat and whose financing came from Democrats, who was trying to be a spoiler, who was basically trying to knock Jackson off the court, and he was successful in doing so. Anita Earls got less than 50% of the vote, and the combined Republican vote was about 50.5%. So as with all of these statewide races, there was a clean Democratic sweep of these judicial races, even though Republicans cast more ballots by, I think, about 52%. Ballot statewide for legislative and House races. So Democrats still swept all the statewide races, even so.
The state's second highest court, also the Court of Appeals, saw Democrats winning all three races for seats there. So now that we know that Democrats have done so well in these judicial statewide races, what does that mean going forward?
Well, what that means going forward is that there's a very good chance that the notion that some Democrats were pushing of sue till you're blue is going to be emphasized even more. I think the biggest policy area to watch out for this is in the area of school choice, and especially the Opportunity Scholarship Program, which the teachers union and the other education establishment members and lots of Democrats have wanted to get rid of from the beginning. The Supreme Court has upheld that opportunity scholarships are constitutional, but Democrats want to get rid of it, and they may well try to figure out some vehicle to go to the courts with the expectation that if it does reach the Supreme Court, that with a 5-2 majority now, that they can declare those unconstitutional.
Rick, let's talk about the actual ballots and the number of people who were running for some of these races. And our listeners may be thinking, hey, wait a second, on that Supreme Court race, there were two Republicans there and one Democrat. How is it possible to have two Republicans running in the same race? Well, that gets back to some legislative activity that turned out really to undermine the work of the Republican majority in the General Assembly, undermining a Republican candidate.
Yeah, Republicans probably lost two Supreme Court seats because of some of their attempts to be clever with the law. They attempted earlier in this decade to replace the direct elections in a one-versus-one contest legislatively with retention elections for judges who were up, whose terms had ended, which the judge's name would appear on the ballot. Voters would give them a yes or no for an additional term. And then if there was a no vote, then you'd have to have an actual election to settle this race between candidates. Well, that was determined to be unconstitutional because they tried to change something in statute that was defined in the Constitution. Elections were defined as contests between two or more candidates. So that didn't work. Then the Republicans said, well, let's just do away with the judicial primaries and have this as sort of a free-for-all race, thinking for some reason that Democrats would have lots of candidates trying to get that Supreme Court seat and one Republican, the incumbent Barbara Jackson, doing so. Well, it didn't turn out that way. The Democrats coalesced behind Anita Earls very early, and when the filing period was about to close, Chris Anglin, who is an attorney who's never served on a court before, changed his registration from Democrat to Republican a few weeks before the filing deadline ended, and then filed as a Republican and went in and got enough of the votes to knock Barbara Jackson off the court.
So that's how it went in the judicial statewide races, a really good night for North Carolina Democrats. Now, conversely, the Republicans seem to have had a pretty good night when it came to those constitutional amendments that were on the ballot. There were six of them. We know that, first of all, four passed, two went down, and the two that went down had to do with a power-shifting arrangement, taking some power away from the governor's office and giving it over to the General Assembly. That's where we had those five former governors who came out against that. They appear to have had an impact there.
And I'm not sure that you could say it was a good night for Republicans on the amendments even, simply because they assumed that all six would pass easily. They had polled these particular items and said, look, these are things that are popular with our voters. Not necessarily they're sure that they were good policy, but they were popular with their voters. And if we get them on the ballot, we'll draw our voters to the polls, and therefore we will maintain our supermajorities in the General Assembly. This would translate down ballot to races. Instead, it kind of backfired on them because the amendments were not numbered on the ballot. There was no designation separating one from another except for the titles of the amendments. So therefore, it was very easy for the Democrats to say, well, you know, we may not have any problems with a couple of these amendments, but guess what? Let's just vote against all of them. Nix all six was the hashtag on social media, but also there were signs everywhere saying vote against these misleading amendments or these deceptive amendments without defining what was deceptive or misleading about them at all. And because of that, that held down the support for something like the Victims' Rights Amendment, which still got about 68% of the vote, I think, but was polling in the 80s and 90s in some cases. The amendment on hunting and fishing, which also got pretty high support but not as high as anyone thought since it passed either unanimously or with only one dissenting vote in each chamber of the legislature. And The two amendments that were really the most important to Republicans were the ones changing the structure of state government, the balance between the executive and legislative branches, and those went down very significantly. One of them would have reconstituted the State Board of Elections and Ethics Reform, I think, for the fourth time in 2 years, and because the previous versions had all been struck down in court as unconstitutional violations of the separation of powers. The other one would change how judicial vacancies were filled, taking that that out of the hands of the governor entirely. That's what the five living former governors campaigned against. And so once you had the Nix All Six campaign, the two government structure amendments that were kind of confusing to voters, I think, and the five governors coming out against it, it became fairly easy for voters to say, we don't understand what's going on here. Let's just vote them down.
Let's talk about photo ID to vote. It
right.
did pass. One
yeah.
of the four
yes.
that passed. And so now going forward, later this month, then the legislature has to actually define the language, write the language to go into the Constitution, correct?
That's right. That's right. They've scheduled a special session for the week after Thanksgiving to pass any implementing legislation necessary. And they've been struck down several times in court, federal and state, about the voter ID requirement. I'm hearing some people suggesting that what the General Assembly should basically do is embrace the language in a North Dakota law, which just passed the muster of the U.S. Supreme Court. Whatever it says, just copy that language, include that, and then when someone inevitably sues, as someone will, as it's calling it voter suppression, then you can say, well, the Supreme Court said this was fine, so let's go with it.
So you're predicting legal challenge no matter what?
Oh, absolutely, because there are advocates, especially on the left, who just say any attempt to require identification at the polls is voter suppression.
Wouldn't that actually put North Carolina in the mainstream, though, in terms of those laws?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think something like 30 states or more have some sort of ID requirement at the polls.
We've been talking with Rick Henderson. He is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Rick Henderson, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.